This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Security was tight as police and military forces stood guard at key government buildings and installations. Officers wore their dress uniforms as they kept watch over voters arriving at polling stations.
That's Edward Yerenyen reporting from Cairo. Details coming up also. Ethiopian security forces have re-arrested a number of recently freed politicians, journalists, and bloggers. And it is unclear if the runoff for Sierra Leone's presidential election will take place tomorrow as scheduled. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Egyptians cast their ballots today on the first of 3 days of voting in what appears to be a certain victory for incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Supporters of the president applauded, while some opponents cried foul, and still others appear to be disinterested in the outcome one way or the other. Edward Yerenyen reports from Cairo.
Supporters of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi held an impromptu rally for their candidate in Cairo's Tahrir Square as voting got underway Monday at polling stations across the capital and Egypt's 14 provinces. Security was tight as police and military forces stood guard at key government buildings and installations. Officers wore their dress uniforms as they kept watch over voters arriving at polling stations. Army helicopters overflew parts of the capital. One middle-aged voter traded banter with polling workers as he dipped his finger in the indelible ink container after slipping his vote into a plastic ballot box at a school in the Giza district of Do'i. Elsewhere, Egyptian TV showed a smiling President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi shaking hands with electoral workers as he cast his ballot in the Cairo district of Heliopolis. A large crowd of villagers gathered outside a polling station in the province of Dakhalia as women ululated from time to time to applaud those who were going in to vote. A voter named Ashraf told VOA that despite some misgivings, he was optimistic the situation in Egypt was heading in the right direction.
This is a transition period and it's not guaranteed to be the maximum, our hopes. Hopefully by the end of the second term of the president, we will be ready for the next step.
Al Jazeera TV, which supports the Muslim Brotherhood group now outlawed in Egypt, reported the group had urged its supporters to abstain from voting. Several secular parties also recently called on their supporters not to vote as well. The secular Al-Ghad party, whose leader Musa Mustafa Musa is the only candidate to oppose President Sisi in the current election, told supporters that he did not care who won so long as everyone turned out to vote. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In a surprise move earlier this year, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn announced that members of political parties and other individuals would be released from prison in an effort to open up so-called political space. The announcement was made after months of the worst political protest in that country. Now, press reports indicate that Ethiopian security forces have re-arrested a number of recently freed politicians, journalists, and bloggers. To shed light on the matter, we have with us in studio VOA journalist Salem Salamone. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Salem, to start with, where did this re-arrest take place?
Our Horn of Africa colleagues, Solomon Abatention, Girma, are calling. It happened in Addis Ababa in the house of one of the journalists that were recently released, Temeskinda Saling. Our colleague spoke to him yesterday, and police stormed into the home of Temeskinda Saling, and they came with pickup trucks, and they took them to a police station. And the reasons that they gave them is that they had a question about the flag that they had during the event. The event was organized to celebrate the release in early January of politicians, journalists, and bloggers in Ethiopia. This was organized for the youth to say thank you for your work, and police stormed and arrested
You mentioned flags. What is so different about the flags they were showing, the reason?
And so there were different speculations about the reasons given. Just to be clear, government officials haven't clearly responded or given reason why they are arresting the journalists and political opposition figures. But what we are hearing and what people are assuming, first of all, Ethiopia is under a state of emergency right now that was declared in mid-February. And so gatherings of any large group, some people are saying because of gathering of any small or large group might be under scrutiny for that reason. But the flag that you mentioned is Ethiopia has a flag with a star on it. And I think the gathering didn't have that star that symbolizes the coalition, the ruling coalition of PRDF, which is the political control in the country right now.
So this has something to do with the state of emergency rule imposed on the country. Who were arrested, and what was the specific misdeed? Like you said, the flag, but anything else?
Just to be clear, those are speculations, and the government hasn't come out and said this is the reason why we're arresting them. Mm-hmm. People are saying maybe because of the state of emergency. The state of emergency doesn't allow for gatherings of large group. The state of emergency was declared recently. This is the second time the country has declared it, specifically because the ongoing protests that are going on. When the protests started a couple of years ago, almost it's been over 3 years, organized protests demanding land, demanding human rights, demanding political representation for different parts. The Oromia region was hit and also spread to the Hamara region. But this recent arrest that happened yesterday, is basically backtracking on what the initiative everybody thought, that the government was releasing prisoners and having some sort of democratic reform that everybody thought. And so I don't know what the government is trying to send a message, but that's people are taking it as taking one step forward and then...
Rights groups often, opposition groups constantly accuse the Ethiopian government of, like, stifling dissent, arresting, rearresting journalists, bloggers, activists. How does that look for the overall image of Ethiopia, which we have to note is a key security ally of the West?
That's correct. In fact, civil rights groups, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, all of them have been very vocal about how the government uses these fig leaf to say, be it the flag, be it the state of emergency, to arrest and stifle dissent in a way that they arrest reporters for these laws that they have. And so they've been very criticized. So the recent announcement of release of journalists and politicians has been very welcomed by civil society groups. Thousands of people were released, I think over 6,000. When the Prime Minister, Hailemariam Desalegn, announced that he was going to resign, everybody thought, okay, this is a surprise move, and then now this is happening. And so Ethiopia is undergoing right now a very interesting period where there's rift between the ruling party. It's going through an interesting process, and they're about to have a new prime minister sometime soon. So we have to wait and see.
Lots of unresolved issues in that country. So VOA Salem Solomon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
It's unclear if the runoff for Sierra Leone's presidential election will take place tomorrow as scheduled amid legal wrangling. A lawyer linked to the ruling party launched a legal challenge to the runoff alleging fraud. The High Court agreed Saturday to delay the balloting, but the court reversed itself today and ruled that the election could proceed. It was unclear if there is enough time to pull together the balloting process for tomorrow. Opposition leader Julius Maada Bio won the first round of voting on March 7th, but he didn't get the required 55% of votes to avoid a runoff. He faces former Foreign Minister Samora Camara, the candidate of the ruling All People's Congress. President Ernest Bau Koroma will step aside after the vote. Kenya has agreed to accelerate a health agreement it signed with Cuba last year and bring 100 doctors from the country to fill gaps in Kenyan hospitals. 50 Kenyan doctors will also be sent to Cuba for specialized training. Rael Ombor reports.
The Kenyan government says the deal to import Cuban doctors would help counter gaps in Kenya's medical facilities. Kenya Cabinet Secretary for Health Cecily Kariuki explains.
The target is to bring 100 specialized doctors from Cuba. One, because of the HR resource gap that we have. We are careful not to cloud the place with general doctors. And therefore, the aim of my ministry is to bring forward critical care physicians at that level, family physicians, physicists, oncologists, and surgeons dealing with plastic reconstructive surgery, dealing with orthopedic surgery, and dealing with neurosurgery.
Each Kenyan county is expected to get at least two of the specialist doctors. But Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union Chairman Samuel Oroko says the move will not address the systemic dysfunction in Kenya's health system.
There are no drugs, theaters are not functioning, laboratories are not functioning. So even if they come, and the system is not functioning, they're coming just to be idle. And they may not get equipment to use to train our own. So we need to look at all angles of our health system. Don't just bring in because of bringing in. Also ensure the system is functional. As they come, they can also operate.
The agreement will also see Kenya work with Cuba on collaborative research projects, training for healthcare workers, and collaborations in fields such as genetic engineering and biotech work. Former Kenyan Minister of Medical Services, Professor Anyang Nyong'o, visited Cuba and says Kenya will benefit from the agreement.
But as a health minister, I came here and we were trying to work things together. And I actually proposed some things that we need to do. For example, malaria vector control, collaborating with the Teaching Engineering Biotechnology Center and all that. But unfortunately, we didn't get far. What gives me satisfaction this time is that the president is determined that we implement these long-standing proposals of collaboration between us and Cuba.
Oroko says the medical union is not against any collaboration or partnership with other governments.
Our appeal and our advice is to consider to bring in expertise from other countries. We need to exhaust what we have locally, and if we lack capacity locally, then we should focus on training our own so that they can be used to manage our patients in Kenya.
The union says more than 1,200 Kenyan doctors have been unemployed since May 2017.
Equally, we do have a number of doctors who have qualified, both general practitioners and specialists, who are not being employed and they are Kenyan.
Kariuki says there are plans to absorb the graduate doctors into the healthcare system, but she says Kenya will still not be able to meet the recommended doctor-to-patient ratio. Oroko says about 4,300 doctors work in the public sector for Kenya's 38.6 million people.
There is the required number of doctors we are supposed to have as a facility, and that is public knowledge. WHO requires to have one doctor per 1,000 patients in any given population. Currently in Kenya, we only have one doctor per 24,000 patients. Where are they going to get the money to say, the ones coming from Cuba.
The union blocked attempts by the government to bring in doctors from Tanzania at the height of its 3-month strike last year. The agreement ending the strike called for pay increases and medical risk allowances. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Egypt is mediating continuous talks between Libyan military officials to unify the Libyan military establishment. But a recent meeting of Libyan mayors in Tripoli expressed concern that unifying the military first might lead to a military takeover of the executive branch. Mufta Al-Tayer is a former Libyan ambassador to Mexico. He explained to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi the complicated political landscape in Libya that could result in different scenarios.
I might say none of the above. The meeting in Egypt, the final press release was not strong, was not convincing. It's true that the attendance was high level from both sides. Looks like it is symbolic more than anything else. To unify the military in Libya, which could lead to one of either step you mentioned, have to be preceded by specific steps. The landscape right now in Libya is very complicated and more than to be solved by a meeting to unify the army, while in fact there are other powers on the ground more organized, more armed than the army itself. I am looking at it as a thing, as symbolic more than anything else.
In Tripoli, the capital hosted a meeting of Libyan mayors in which mayors insisted that unifying the executive authority should precede unifying the army. Is that a better way for Libya?
The statement itself in itself is noble and welcomed by the Libyans. The meeting you are referring to is the second one. The first one was last year in the eastern part of Libya in a city called Shahat. The press release contains three recommendations. The first one is insisting on the unity of the Libyan land and the Libyan country. And with that is try to hard work on improving the well-being of the citizens in Libya. The second recommendation talk about forming a committee, help both the parliament in the east and in the west to come up with a solution toward getting us out of this. The third one, which is the important one, is that if this failed, then they have recommended that you return the authority to the Supreme Court, which had 1 year to have to pace the road for an election in Libya after they choose a government. Any effort that could lead us toward an exit from this pass, which we have been installed in, is welcomed by the Libyans. But remember, these are the mayors, and it depends how other parties are welcoming and supporting their effort.
Observers cited a big obstacle facing a political solution in Libya, which is Eastern Libyan camp in Benghazi pushing for elections before drafting a constitution, while the Western Libyan camp in Tripoli insisting on a constitution first. Could that be reconciled between the two sides?
It's not impossible, but however, let us begin with that the elections is becoming a very popular demand in Libya, and Libyans are putting so many hopes on it to get them out of this mess. But it's not easy. It's true that Libyans are in a desperate situation. But to have an election to begin with, the great obstacle right now against this is stability, which is also is threatened. This stability is threatened by the local militia, foreign intervention, and sometimes foreign silence of some powers. Yesterday, the Human Rights Watch released a press release about the difficulty of having election right now. Of course, to have an election law or amendment, the second law, is important. But both of them need a constitutional, recognized internationally entity to do that.
That was former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, Mufta Al-Tayer. He was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. The European Union says it is extremely worried about conditions in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United Nations considers the humanitarian conditions there to be at its highest level of emergency, yet the Kinshasa government says it will not attend a scheduled donors conference on April 13th. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell recently was in the DRC reporting. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the situation there.
This aid conference in April in Geneva is an opportunity for the United Nations to raise the $1.7 billion it says it needs to address the numerous humanitarian crises across the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a nation the size of Western Europe.
Why is the DRC government saying it won't go to the aid conference next month?
Yes, so the Congolese government says it will not attend because they believe that an event like this portrays a bad image of the country. And in that way, they're not wrong. Images of starving children do not inspire investor confidence, which is what the government says it needs right now to continue developing and ostensibly to avoid a repeat of these horrible crises in the future. But it's also important to note the context. In 9 months, Congo is going to be headed towards elections, which have now been delayed for 2 years. And the powers that be need to convince their own voters that they're in control and that they have improved the lives of their people. And a conference like this really highlights their extreme failures. And so as such, it's a terrible campaigning ploy for, or a terrible campaign blow, I guess, for the ruling party and the governing party in Congo. So they are very much opposed to it.
Anita, you were just there in the DRC speaking with scores of Congolese civilians, as well as some aid workers. What are the conditions you saw there and that they spoke to you about?
Yes, so I spent 3 days recently in Kasai region, which is a large region. It's three provinces about the size of Germany in south central Congo. And it's important to note just the context. This has always been a poor area. Even before the security crisis, 50% of children in this area were chronically malnourished. But in the last 18 months, Kasai province has seen an exodus of 1.4 million people after conflict flared up there 18 months ago. And so it is a dire situation. The UN warns that up to 400,000 children could die this year of acute malnutrition if they don't receive the aid that they say that they need to help these children. So the needs are great. And in Kasai region, people have said to me that they are desperate, that they need help, and they don't really care where it comes from. They just need help now. And so in that regard, this aid conference hopes to address that, because this hasn't been exactly forthcoming from the government of Congo, which is struggling in other regions of the country. And this is not the only crisis that they have on their hands.
VOA's Anita Powell talking to my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Tune in at 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.